as the chairperson. So our speaker today is Florian Conradi. He's going to speak about spin foams with time-like surfaces. Florian?
Hello. This is Florian. Good morning or good afternoon. Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So as Corke said, my talk is about spin foams with time-like surfaces. This is work together with Jeff Nivida, who is a master's student here at Perimeter. And the content of the talk is about these two papers that you see down here. Let's move to the next slide. The outline of the talk, first of all, I'll give some motivation. Then I describe the definition of the coherent states, which will be essential for the definition of these spin foams. And then I'll come to the simplicity constraints, and I'll show that one can derive them in three different ways. And finally, I define the spin foams themselves and conclude with a summary. Next slide. For some motivation. So the main innovations of the last years were the introduction of the new spin form models, the EPRL model by the Marseille group, which was based on a master constraint and led to a better coupling between force implicities and also to a link with canonical loop quantum gravity. The other important thing was the introduction of the group coherent states by Liebin and Speciale. There, the idea was that one could use these states to impose simplicity constraints by imposing them on expectation values of the states. That led to a better geometric understanding of intertwiners and also to the FK model, which is related to the EPRL model introduced by Friedel and Krasnov. Let's go to the next slide. Now, the thing is that when you consider the Lorentzian EPRL model, there's a restriction, namely the condition that normals of tetrahedra should be always time-like. That means in particular that tetrahedra will be always Euclidean, and the triangles in them can be only space-like. Next slide. What we did is to extend the EPRL model to also include space-like normals. As you see in this picture, therefore now Lorentzian tetrahedra are allowed, and the triangles in these can be either space-like or time-like. Next slide. So overall, we'll have the following three cases. First, the EPRL one, and then two new ones with a space-like tetrahedral normal. And one case is that the triangle in there is space-like, and the other case is that it is time-like. Let's go to the next slide, please. Now, this extension, I would say, is very natural from a covariant perspective. A priori, there's no reason to forbid Lorentzian tetrahedra if we can deal with them. Moreover, this has the virtue that it permits time-like boundaries, which wasn't possible before. And another thing that one could think about is that if we restrict triangulation, that could possibly lead to artifacts in the dynamics. And if I leave the triangulation is more general, then that may not happen. Next slide, please. How about the canonical perspective? In Zakopane, where I already talked about this, there came up the question, well, are triangulations of the EPRL type perhaps preferred from a Hamiltonian point of view? But, because then everything is sort of space-like. Well, let me say the following about this. In examples I know of, the transition from a space to a space-time picture leads to a 40 lattice with time-like or null edges. So, an example for this would be causal dynamical triangulation. Another one are evolution schemes for Lorentzian Reggie calculus. I drew a little cartoon of that down here on the left-hand side. So one starts from a spatial triangulation, and then by using tent moves, one lets slowly grow a 4D triangulation from this. And the red edges that you see here should represent time-like edges. On the right-hand side, you see the alternative, like where I've deleted these time-like edges. And perhaps it would be possible to have also an evolution scheme where you have only space-like edges. But I don't know of any examples for this. The second remark I want to do here, and here I will just flip to another point on the same slide. The other remark is that in the Hamiltonian approach to the Lorentzian spin form, one obtains currently a sequence of 3D spatial lattices, as far as I understand. It's work by Muqin Han and Thomas Thiemann. And right now, these lattices cannot yet be directly compared with 4D triangulations because there's not yet the link between the different spatial lattices. So what this tells me is that I wouldn't say that restricted triangulations are preferred from the Hamiltonian point of view. In fact, in the cases I know of, you do have time-like links in the triangulation. Let's move on to the next slide. This is now the section about coherent states. I put a lot of details into the slide, and I won't possibly be able to talk about all this, so I will be fast and skip over a number of things. But if you're interested in hearing more details so that I go more slow, please chat. First, again, the different cases. I have to talk about the groups that are involved. We gauge fix the normal for the different possibilities. And when it's time-like, it will become 1, 0, 0, 0. And in the space-like case, we'll have 0, 0, 0, 1. This choice of the normal vector defines a little group, the first case SO3 and then others SO12. As usual in loop quantum gravity, we use the double cover. If you flip to the next overlay here, so we're dealing with SU2 and SU11. Please go to the next slide. Correspondingly, we have to deal with the representation theory of SL2C, and then also of SU2 and SU11. Here I will review a few basics that we'll need in the rest of the talk. We have the generators JI and KI of SL2C, then the Casimir unitary irreducible representations of SL2C will be labeled by numbers rho and n. Rho is a real number and n is a positive integer. Below you see the Casimir is expressed in terms of these. Then the subgroup SU2 has the usual generators in Casimir, will be labeled, a unitary error will be labeled by DJ. And on the next slide, you see the corresponding quantities for SU11, which may be less familiar. So now the generators are J3, K1, and K2. You have the Casimir built from these. And other than in SU2, you now have two types of irreducible representations. Unitary irreducible representations. There's the discrete series, which is labeled by discrete spins, starting with 1/2. And then you have the continuous series, which is also by a labeled spin, but now with a continuous parameter, x. And below you see also the Casimir. One Casimir in the discrete series is mostly positive, and the other one for the continuous series is negative. That will play a role later. A word on notation. As usual, I put the generators of H2 together in a vector J and likewise the boosts in a vector K. These transform like Euclidean 3 vectors under H2. Now, for H211, I can do something similar and put the generators of H21 together as a vector F and the complementary vector I call G. And these two vectors transform like Minkowski 3 vectors under H21. So the situation is pretty analogous to what we did in SU2 before. Next slide, please. Most of you know about this. If I have an SL2C irreducible representation, it will decompose into irreducible representations of SU2. We have a canonical basis corresponding to this. So the decomposition of the Hilbert space you see on the slide, and then the completeness relation, these canonical states of spin J and magnetic quantum number M are denoted by psi JM. I use the symbol psi to distinguish this state from the SU2 representation by itself, because this difference will play a role. So whenever you see the symbol psi, this means now I'm talking about these states as states in the FLCC representation. So similarly, you can decompose FLCC in terms of S211 arrest. Now things are more complicated. Above on the first line, you see, that's now slide 16, by the way. So in the first line, you see the isomorphism of states. You have a direct integral for the continuous series. The continuous series appears two times with this parameter s, and then you have the plus and the minus copy of the discrete series. Below that, I've written the completeness relation with state psi plus minus, and then also state psi s labeled by the continuous parameter s. They have an additional parameter alpha because I have two copies of the continuous series. I label them by 1 and 2. Details of this can be, for example, found in Will's book on harmonic analysis. Let's please move to the next slide. A particularity of the continuous series is that there's an issue of non-normalizability. As such, in the continuous series, the states Jn are normalizable. But when I think of them as states in the FLCC representation, they are not. That you can see in this orthogonality relation, you will get a delta function that contains the parameter s. Next slide, number 18. To write the spin form model in the end, in terms of coherent states and vertex amplitudes, we need to use completeness relations of coherent states. So I will now go with you through the different completeness relations for the different types of irreducible representation. The first case is U2, which is probably well known to many of you. Coherent states are defined by taking the highest weight state and then acting with a representation on it. And you can parameterize them by group elements, therefore. Alternatively, you can go to the quotient at U2 by U1 that gives you a vector of two-sphere, and then you get coherent states labeled by these vectors, three vectors. You see the completeness relation below either written in terms of group elements or vectors. This is stated at the level of a single error of spin J. If I translate that into the SLGC ERP, where the spin J ERP is a subspace, then that gives me the bottom line here. I have a projector onto the irreducible representation of spin J, and I can express it as an integral over coherent state psi JG if I label them by group elements, or psi JN if I label them by vectors. And next slide, please. I'll go fast now, because most of these structures are analogous when I talk about SU11. So again, SU11 coherent states are defined by acting with the representation on reference states, here J plus minus J. You can also use vectors. This time the vectors will be elements not of the two-sphere, but of the upper and lower hyperboloid. We're now dealing with Lorentz space is correspondingly used now, the hyperboloid. And if you flip to the next specification on the slide, to slide 19, you see the completeness relation for this, and then also how it translates to states in the FLCC ERP in the bottom line. Next slide, please. So far as this is known, these coherent states and the completeness relations have been defined by Perelomer, and they have the property that the expectation value is equal to their classical label. That is, if I take the expectation value with respect to J, then I'll get the vector Jn. The corresponding statement holds for the irreducible representation of SU11. And what you can see here is that fits with the sign of the Casimir state square is positive, so I get a time-like vector. And also F squared is positive, so in this Minkowskian setting, it will be also a time-like vector in the upper or lower hyperbolic. Next slide. The question is, what would be the appropriate coherent state for the continuous series? In this case, the Casimir will give something negative. So I would expect that the classical vector and labeling the coherent state should be space-like. Now, what Perelman does is, in this case, he uses the state J M, where M is equal to 0. And that results in a 0 classical vector. So that's not what we want to do. If you flip the slide, you see what we do. Namely, you think, okay, the relevant generator is S. And if I want to get something space-like, I better should have some, as reference states, I should better use eigenstates of K1 or K2, because that will lead to the space-like component. That's the strategy. He therefore introduced new coherent states. You see that on the next slide, 22, using eigenstates of K1. A long time ago, this has been treated in the literature. You can define these states. They have a continuous spectrum with eigenvalues lambda. There's also degeneracy. That's the reason why you have a second label, sigma, equal to plus minus. Because of the non-compact nature of the group, you now have states that are not normalizable, that you see in orthogonality relations. And if you want to obtain finite inner products, one needs a smear with a wave function. That's similar to the situation when you deal with, say, momentum eigenstates and you smear them with wave functions. Slide 23, please. Now, in analogy to what we did before, we now define coherent states by acting with the representation. We take a reference state, J, now with a specific value for lambda equal to S, and then we pick a value for this degeneracy label and define a coherent state like this. Now one can see that the appropriate label is a vector in the space-like half of hyperbolic. So that's, all this fits very well. The space-like hyperbolic is the quotient of XU11 with the subgroup generated by K1. But that's the thing I haven't mentioned yet. Flip, please, to the next part of the slide. So that I have get finite inner products, I want to smear these states, because otherwise I have this singular inner product. So I introduce an integral over lambda. I smear it a little bit around the specific value x. The function, the smearing function, is defined at the bottom of the slide. It basically just allows a little window around the main value x, of a window of width delta. On slide 24, we can then see the completeness relation that I get from this. So it looks very much like what we had before. So I can describe it in terms of an integral over group element, or in the bottom expression, you can also express it in terms of vectors of the space-like hyperbolic. There's a slight difference here that now I can't, in that case, I can't really absorb this smearing factor into the states themselves. It's an integral over both coherent states, both the bra and the cat, that makes the notation a bit cumbersome. But still, it's all quite analogous. Slide 25. Due to the special property of the continuous series I mentioned before, I also need a smearing in S if I want to get finite inner product. In particular, I don't want to project, if I talk about a particular continuous series subspace in the SLCC representation, I don't want to project onto a single value of X, because that will give me these non-normalizable states. Instead, I want to smear it a little bit, so I define a smeared projector, which also depends on delta. So you can see how I have a completeness relation in terms of bras and cats here, basis states of the continuous series, and I allow a certain window of values of X around the main value S. Next slide, please. Accordingly, then, I define coherent states by smearing both in the eigenvalue of K1 lambda and the label of the irreducible representation S. That gives me the first expression. And in the second expression, you see that I can express the projector onto the irreducible representation with label S in terms of these coherent states. So that's one of the things things, the new things that we show in our papers. Next slide. Yeah, so we've come here to the end of the section on trivia and state. So if you want to ask a question now, please do so. So there are no questions, then I'll just proceed. The next section is about the quantum simplicity constraints. As I said, there are three ways to derive them, as we show in our paper. The first one is the weak imposition of constraints. The second one, the master constraint. Both were advocated by the work of EPRL and used in their paper. And the third method that we will use is a restriction of a coherent state basis. And that is essentially inspired by the Kreider-Krasnov model. Next slide, please, 29. Briefly, the general strategy for quantization. We start from a tetrahedron, classically, and describe it by four bivectors that you see here, like J equal to the bivector B plus an immunity term. The immunity parameter is gamma. And now I want constraint B to be simple, allowing us to describe the triangles of the tetrahedron. The simplicity constraint is formulated in terms of the normal to the tetrahedron, namely U times star B is equal to zero for all the bivectors of four bivectors of the triangle. For all bivectors of the tetrahedron. Slide 30. What one does then is one expresses the B's in terms of the total bivector J, giving you the first formula on this slide. And then the starting point for the quantization is just to impose the simplicity constraint, which gives you the second equation. Now, these equations we try to translate into the quantum theory. Slide 31. The first case is the EPRL case, namely where the normal is time-like. We fix the gauge, putting it to 1, 0, 0, 0, and then the simplicity constraint can be expressed in terms of the three vectors J and K, as you see below. Since the little group is now SG2, we will use states of the SG2 decomposition to quantize triangles. Slide 32. On the other hand, when we look at the case with space-like U, that is U equal to 0, 0, 0, 1, the simplicity constraint is expressed in terms of these vectors, Minkowski vectors, F and G, that I mentioned before. And the formula for the simplicity constraint is, again, quite analogous. The little group is SG11, and we use states of the SG11 decomposition. Slide 33. Now, an issue when quantizing these constraints is that they're second class. And so before I come to the quantization, I want to discuss first a simple toy model that was already mentioned in the EPRL paper. Consider just a pair of QP variables with small brackets and assume that the Q and the P are constrained to be the same. So physically, we would just expect this corresponds to one system, Q and P. One can make a change of variables here, express it in terms of variables Q plus minus, P plus minus. Then the constraint is that Q minus and P minus is equal to zero. Or you can go use like complex variables A plus minus, and the constraint is then the condition that A minus is zero. Next slide, slide 34. Now, one strategy, as argued in the EPRL paper, is to impose constraints weakly. Here, we would do that by saying we only require that the operator A minus acting on physical states gives zero, and that implies then that the constraint holds weakly in the sense that matrix elements of A minus and A minus dagger are zero for all states in the physical Hilbert space. With that, we can then show, okay, the physical Hilbert space is just given by those states that have Fock excitations for the plus part, while with regard to the operator A minus, it's in the vacuum. Next slide, 35. The other strategy is to use the coherent state as a link between classical and quantum theory. We start from an overcomplete basis of coherent states in the full Hilbert space. We have these eigenvalues of the annihilation operators, alpha plus minus, and then I can express the identity in the kinetic Hilbert space as an integral over these labels, A plus and A minus. And then I say, well, let's restrict the basis of coherent states to those states that have expectation values that satisfy the constraints. That is, those states that have the label alpha minus is equal to zero. That gives us a new resolution, a resolution of a projector into the physical Hilbert space, where only the alpha plus label is non-zero and the alpha minus is zero. And that gives us, in fact, the same physical Hilbert space in the case, as in the case method before. The third method you see on page 36, the mass constraint operator, essentially the Hamiltonian here. You define a physical Hilbert space as the subspace of state with minimal eigenvalue with respect to this operator. And then again, the physical Hilbert space will be spent by those states that have only excitation in the plus part. Slide 37, please. Next, I will try to use these same three methods for the simplicity constraints. And before I do so, I will anticipate the result, tally what's going to come out. Namely, from the simplicity constraints themselves, you will get a relation between the Casimir of the subgroup and a Casimir of FLC here. That's the equation 4 gamma Casimir 3 equal to rho times n. That's one condition. So what 3 is, C3 is, depends on the little group in question. And then the second constraint that we will use is the so-called diagonal constraint. That one is much easier to quantize. It can be simply expressed in terms of Casimir's of FLCC. And it's essentially the product of two factors that you see in the second equation here. So that can be dealt with pretty easily. Slide 38. Let's consider the first case, namely the weak imposition of constraints, and let's look at a time-like normal. Suppose that the physical Hilbert space is made up of a certain sum of spin J errors. So you have a subset, perhaps, of the total set of spins, and now you require that the constraint, the simplicity constraint, should be satisfied weakly on this Hilbert space. Unless the physical Hilbert space is trivial, there should be at least some spin then where the simplicity constraint is satisfied weakly. That's the bottom equation. So this should be satisfied for all admissible state in this representation. Now you can work out what that means. You can use the commutation relations and also the action of the boosts on the canonical basis. And then one obtains so let me explain this. So you have the action of K3 on a canonical basis state. The states that will be relevant for us on the right-hand side will be just those where the spin stays the same. There are also right terms where the spin is increased and decreased. But since we sandwich with states of the spin gear from the left in our matrix elements, these will disappear. So we only care about spin J. The coefficient of this term is called AJ and is related to the Casimirs. So when you work this out, what the equation, the constraint on the previous slide means, then you see that this gives you that AJ is equal to gamma, or that 4 gamma times Casimir is equal to rho n. And that's precisely the first equation that I was talking about, the first condition on error that I was talking about on the previous slide. When I now plug this together with the diagonal constraint, this gives me that 4 times the Casimir has to be n squared if I use one solution, namely rho equals to gamma n, or that 4 times the Casimir will be minus rho squared if n is equal to minus gamma rho. These two possibilities correspond to the two solutions of the diagonal simplicity constraint. Now, the second one gives a contradiction, only the first one is possible, and there I can solve it approximately, giving you the solution that you see below. So then the physical Hilbert space is defined by the irreducible representation of spin n half. And that's the EPRL solution. So we've reproduced what was already known. We can do exactly the same game for the case of space-like normal. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I just want to tell you, okay, one can do this. You see here corresponding equations. One has to use the action of boost on states of the discrete and continuous series. The action of these generators has been worked out a long time ago by Mukunda. And then one gets the solution at the bottom for the discrete series. So again, rho has to be equal to gamma n, and j has to be equal to n half. But now we're talking about irreducible representations of the discrete series, no longer about SG2 representations. The condition that n has to be bigger than 2 comes from the fact that in the Foster-Wells decomposition, you're not allowed to have spin equal to 1 half. It was actually wrong in an original paper, and we corrected that. So the relevant spin for the discrete series starts at most at 1. Similarly, you can do the same thing for the irreducible representation when we're talking about the continuous series. The equations are the same. Let's look at the bottom. So you have the left side, which I just discussed, and then the right side, where you have a new solution. The difference is now that you have a new sign coming from the Casimir of SU11, and that results in us having to use the second possibility and the diagonal constraint, namely rho equal to minus n gamma. And below that, then you see the solution for the physical Hilbert space. Slide 42. Now I want to discuss the second method of deriving things, namely the restriction of the coherent state basis. Let's talk about the case with time-like anomalies. We've resolved the identity on the SOGC ERB in terms of SG2 coherent states. You can express that, as discussed, in terms of an integral over vectors. And then you require that, well, the expectation value of simplistic constraint on the state should be 0. This will imply the first condition, namely that AJ is equal to gamma. It was shown in our first paper. And then on slide 43, how do you get the second condition? It's either obtained directly by using, again, the diagonal constraint. Alternatively, one can require that the uncertainty in K should be minimal. So from what we already have, namely gamma equal to AJ, follows what you see in the first equation here, a relation between the J and the K vectors. And you can plug that into the variance of the boost, as you see at the bottom. And that gives you, in the end, again, the diagonal constraint. That is, if you want to minimize the variance, you effectively have to make the diagonal constraint small. So yes, here are two different ways of proceeding. It gives you a nice physical picture of how the constraints come about. Slide 44. So if you do that now, you start from the original resolution of identity, and then you restrict to those states that satisfy the simplicity constraint, and you get this projector here. You're only using the spin of J equal n half. Slide 45. Finally, the master constraint, you can also use this one. Let's consider the case with space-like normal. Then the master constraint is the square of this constraint, which gives the expression in the first line. You combine this with the diagonal constraint and get, again, the relation between SU11 Casimir and the SOCC Casimir. This is the desired second condition. So altogether, we get, again, the constraint coming from the diagonal constraint and then the relation between the Casimirs, giving you the solution I discussed before. That's slide 46, sorry. And then on slide 47, you can do the same thing for the continuous series, giving you, again, the solution we have, I've mentioned before. Let's let's move on quickly and go to slide 48, where I list all the constraints. You see the three different cases, the little groups, the relevant irreducible representation, the constraints on the labels of the FL2C representation, and then the constraints on the ERBs of its subgroups. And at the bottom, you see then the error spectrum. And the remarkable thing here is that also in the extended cases, that is in the two right columns, you also get a discrete error spectrum, even in the case of the continued series. Let's move on to slide 49, unless you have questions. Do you want to ask any questions at this point? There's a question here.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't, you didn't make this very explicitly clear on here because you just gave the solution, but when I read your paper, using the coherent spaces, your goal is to minimize the uncertainty of the Casimir, right? And the approximate solutions you give are not the ones which minimize the uncertainty. They're close, but they're not the ones which you, do you have some sort of comment to make about that?
Yeah, that's pretty, to be expected, because I can't even do it. If you just look at your two states and you just think about angular momentum, even there you can't put the variance to zero.
No, I'm not saying putting the variance to, in the normal SU2 thing, the coherent states are the ones which minimize the uncertainty.
Yes.
Here the ones which you chose are not the ones which minimize, like, the uncertainty. So if you, in the SU2 case, if you take the highest weight state and you act on G, that's the ones which are minimizing the uncertainty. But in the ones you did here for the SU11, the coherent states, which you call coherent states, are not the ones which actually minimize the uncertainty.
Are you talking about the continuous series?
Yeah, I believe it's the continuous series, yeah. But
yeah, the thing is, that, I mean, are you talking about the possibility that I could let the uncertainty go to minus infinity? Is that, are you talking about signs here? Because I would say that...
No. The absolute value of the uncertainty.
I would say that I get that as close to zero as I can.
You could choose other choices of J's, and you basically have a quadratic equation in these J's, and you basically make it so that it doesn't depend on the J instead of minimizing it for just anything. We can talk about it later.
There may be some leeway here where I can make it slightly different. I would say that this isn't really a fundamental issue here. But,
I think the comment is about order and ambiguity that you can adjust.
There's another remark by it.
I think the question was about order and ambiguity that you solve the equations only in the approximation of large J, and
there's always this issue about you can have these linear terms in J, and there I just proceed as in the EPRL case, and I just choose things for convenience. So I have nothing deeper to say more about the ordering ambiguity or the quantization ambiguity. So now we can move on to slide 49, to the part on spin forms. There's more on slide 50. So as usual, we use a simplicial complex. The triangles are denoted by T and tetrahedra by tau. More importantly, we use the dual complex where vertices are denoted by D, edges by E, and faces by F. So the same variables as in the ERL model with a connection that is assigned to dual edges, and they're the labels of the irreducible representation. But due to the simplicity constraint, this is now only the integer n assigned to faces. The new thing is that we have additional variables, namely the normals of tetrahedra. We could go through these, we have that the variable sketch go through the different possibilities that this variable is associated to a tetrahedron dual to the edge E. And then another label indicates whether a triangle is space-like or time-like. Plus corresponding to space-like and minus corresponding to time-like. Slide 51, please. Now, so that I can cover all these different cases, I have to introduce some uniform notation so that I can write a compact formula. I have the different possibilities for the little group, SU2, SU11, or if I had a time-like triangle in the space-like tetrahedron, that's impossible to output the empty set here. Then the simplicity constraints on the spins require the expression on the bottom of the slide here. That's the solution for the different cases. Let's go to slide 52. I also introduced a uniform mutation for the coherent state. So psi, alpha, j is the spin, then h is now the element of the group. This tells you, that would be on slide 50. So this indicates whether a triangle is space-like or time-like. Plus is space-like, minus is time-like. So plus would be the ordinary case that you already know. Going back to slide 52. So this, like we have these three lines, and these correspond to the three columns that you always saw when I talked about tetrahedra and the triangles in them. And so I denote the coherent state by as psi alpha j and h, that's the group label, and it's in the little group, depending on the value of u and theta. And then depending on these cases, I will have the different coherent states that I described earlier. First line, SU2, second line, discrete series, and third line, continued series. The alpha index there denotes the two different copies of the continued series. Using this, I can now write the projector on these different irreducible representations in terms of a coherence, in terms of a completeness relation that you see below. There's a prefactor, and then an integral over this little group, and then the bra and cat of the coherent state. Slide 53, please. Using the completeness relation, I can now describe the spin form sum in terms of vertex amplitude. Basically, what happens is I have this projector and allows the irreducible representation, and I pull bra and cat apart and pull each of them towards the neighboring vertex. That gives me the vertex amplitude defined here. Let me describe them briefly. So you have the bra and the cat in between the parallel transport from going from one edge through the vertex to the other edge. You do that for each face adjacent to the vertex. Then you have an integral over the parallel transport C, and all this together gives you the vertex amplitude. Slide 54. With this, now I can write down the partition function. Now, what I will do, I will just take the naive approach and say, well, I want to define a sum over Lorentzian geometry, so I will just sum over all possibilities. It is a sum over all possible values of space-like, time-like triangles, and time-like and space-like normals. Of course, I will only allow those cases that are actually allowed by the simplicity constraint. So what do we get then? Well, we have the sum over the label n for the SL2C Earth, then we have the sum over these different possibilities of zeta and u, sum over additional labels, and then for each pair EF, there will be, that corresponds to the completeness relation of the coherent state, there will be an integral over the little group, depending on the choice of space-like time-like triangle and the choice of space-like time-like normal of the tetrahedron. Then, in the second line of this expression, you see a measure factor that's coming from the original EF theory that is constrained. And now rho is replaced by the value that is given by the simplicity constraint. And then in the last, on the right-hand side, you see then the product of a vertex amplitude. The subtlety here is that I introduced this smearing in the states corresponding to time-like triangles, parameterized by delta. So once I've multiplied everything and computed all that in a product, I could get rid of this parameter and that the delta go to zero. That's how I define it here. 65. Now, I said before that I took a naive approach here, with saying, okay, I want the sum of all possibilities allowed by the simplicity constraint. But one can ask a question here. So, in principle, spin-form models are kind of a marriage between the canonical approach and the covariant approach. And one wants to have a certain compatibility of path and well and operator forms. From the canonical perspective, one would wish in particular that the sum of intermediate states on a triangulation's boundary is a projector. It's a natural requirement from the operator point of view. Now, for a given choice of our normal, this is certainly the case. As a result of the simplicity constraint, I always got a projector. But is that also true when I sum over the different normals, when I allow now first the case time-like view and then the case space-like view, and I sum over it in the spin form sum? I will discuss that on the next slide. Let me introduce some color coding. Again, three different cases. The blue one is the normal E pair L one, and green and red correspond to the new one. The green one is again the space-like one, but this time in a tetrahedron that is Lorentzian and has a space-like normal. And the third case is that of a timeline triangle. Note, I wrote also down the simplicity constraints at the bottom, because from that we can see that, in principle, one can have a non-zero inner product between blue and green triangles. They are in the same SL2C representation. While if you try to multiply, have an inner product between a blue triangle and a timeline triangle, that will give you zero, because their simplicity constraints on the SL2C ERG are incompatible. That's important on the next slide, 57, because now we can see that basically what I just said is the left column here, the inner product between triangles. And when I then think about inner products between tetrahedral states, I see that in principle there could be a non-zero inner product between a blue, completely blue tetrahedron and one that is completely green. On the other hand, if there's a timeline triangle in that tetrahedron, due to the orthogonality I just described, this will give you zero. So if we want to have a projector coming from the sum of our boundary states, we can ensure that if we exclude completely green tetrahedra, that is, if we exclude tetrahedral states that only consist of states from the discrete series. If I leave these out, what will remain is the following sum that you see below. Give the sum over the EPRL state in blue, and then I sum over our new state, where the tetrahedra contain at least one red triangle. It could be also more. Due to the orthogonality, I know that this is a projector. At the same time, this boundary, or the corresponding boundary Hilbert space, is generally larger than the EPRL one, because I have this additional second sum. So not only do I have a sum over more general triangulation, from a covariant perspective, it also is reflected in a bigger boundary Hilbert space. So, I come to my summary now, unless you have questions about what was just said. There's a question here.
We have a simple understanding question in your previous slide. In your commutators here, you assume that it's the same triangle.
Oh, it's not a commutator. It's an inner product.
Well, in the inner product here, you assume that it's the same triangle, so it's the same edges, right? So you have six edges on the left-hand side, and it's the same six edges on the right-hand side. Is that right? Or they, can they be like two triangles who share, two tetrahedrons who share one triangle?
The thing is, the picture is a bit misleading if you think literally of edges here, because At that level, the quantum states only describe triangles there, you know, or some kind of surfaces.
Sure.
They are not yet concretely implemented as edges.
Okay.
So take for example the picture with the red part together with the green part, like a tetrahedron has a red and a green part. It means like this one triangle state is red, and there are then three triangle states that are green. That's what I mean.
So what I'm asking is, there's of the four triangles on the left, they're the same four triangles on the right. Is that right? Or are they? Could they be two different tetrahedrons which share only one triangle?
Right in the inner product.
Yeah, in
the
inner product.
What do you mean they are the same? Like
Are on the left and on the right, is it the same tetrahedron, or could it be different tetrahedrons sharing a triangle of the inner product?
Sharing a different triangle. Can you perhaps rephrase the question so that I understand better?
Okay, so suppose on the top right picture, the inner product you have here,
yes.
Could it be that the tetrahedron on the left, suppose I label it 1, could the green tetrahedron, could I label it 2, and it'd be a totally different tetrahedron, except that it shares one triangle with the tetrahedron 1? Or are they both tetrahedron 1 who have exactly...
Oh, there is a difference, because in the green, totally green case, you have a different normal. It's a space-like normal. So you somehow have to squeeze... It's true that in the green case, our triangles are space-like, okay? But since you have a space-like normal, you have to squeeze these space-like triangles into the space that remains. Namely, if you have a space-like normal, there will be a 3D Minkowski space left, and you have to put the space-like triangles into this part. So blue and green tetrahedron will never be, can't possibly... Well, they could be sometimes the same if you do the same squeezing, so to speak, for the blue tetrahedron. So that's the reason why I say there could, in principle, be a non-zero inner product.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is the way you do your inner product. Do you do your inner product by doing the inner product of of all 6 triangles together, or could it be that some of the triangles you don't do the inner product because they're not identified?
The way it works is, so the tetrahedral state comes from the tensor product of 4 triangles. Take the tensor product, you have an order, like 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you have another tetrahedral state also made of a tensor product, and the inner product comes just from individually...
All four of them. Yes, okay, that's what I was asking.
Okay. So let's come finish with the summary. That's slide 59. What we did is we extended the EPRL model. Tetrahedra can be now Euclidean and Lorentzian. Triangles can be space-like or time-like. In the last 2 slides, I also explained that this leads to a generally larger boundary Hilbert space. By the way, the thing that I explained with the colors, that's not yet in the papers. It's just something that occurred to me in the last days, so you won't find that yet there. The other important thing is the error spectrum of time-like surfaces is discrete with defined and associated. Time-like surfaces. Well, of course, we know that it's always discrete for space-like surfaces, but here it's... Due to the simplicity constraint, the continuous parameter is constrained to be related to the integer, and that makes the spectrum discrete as well. And we introduce also these coherent states for time-like triangles. An outlook on slide number 60. So the cool thing is now we can treat regions as time-like boundaries as they were originally envisioned in work by Rovelli and Beckel, the general boundary approach. It's natural to ask now if one can extend results on the EPRL model to the extended case, the asymptotic of the graviton propagator, and more. Also, one might wonder, well, if we're now allowed to have time-like boundaries, can we define some form of operator from this, some form of canonical FGG on this? There's been already some ideas around by Alexandrov and collaborators on this, and we should certainly try to compare our present work with these earlier approaches. So I stop here and thank you.
Questions?
Hello, this is Benjamin Bach from Golem. I have a question. Maybe this is something you have already said, but we have some technical problems, so we just joined in later. In the case of the space-like norm, the second of the 3 cases that you were showing, I think the lowest spin that we can use, you said, is spin 1, and the spectrum of the area operator square root of j times j minus 1. So the lowest eigenvalue gives you is zero area. Is there a geometric interpretation for that? Is this a degenerate tetrahedron one is working with or something?
That to me looks like the case in NST2 when you have the spin equal to zero. So if you think that you need a special interpretation for that, you would also need it for the ST2 case. So I have not more to say about that than in the ST2 case. It's in a state of zero area. There's a thought by Laurent here. I'm sorry, Benjamin, you were talking about the case where the triangle is space-like, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so he's not...
There's a remark by... If you take the discrete series and you take the limit of this code, the representation which corresponds to j equal 1/2 for which the Casimir is zero, then this representation is a unitary representation which is not part of the discrete series, strictly speaking, but corresponds to the null code. So it corresponds to null surfaces.
That's true, but he wasn't talking about spin equal 1/2. Benjamin was talking about spin equal 1, where the area becomes zero.
Wait, is that the limit of discrete series? I'm not sure what's your convention there.
The lowest possible representation is g equal 1.
Benjamin was talking about the case j equal 1. And to me, that seems very much like the case of j equal 0.
All your derivation is in the case anyway of large J where you neglect any operator ordering ambiguity. So it may be related to the previous question that if you choose a different, representative state, you might have a different spectra. Right? I mean, your analysis is valid only in large J limit.
But yes, so you don't make questions about the ordering if you have in the UL case.
Okay, so you're saying this is like the vacuum state for the SU2 case, say in loop quantum gravity, where this is something like an edge that is not there. This is like an area that is not really there.
Well, there's an issue here. Well, yeah, you could say I think you could say it like that. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
More questions? If there are no more questions, just thank the speaker again.